Chapter 3. Asgiliac. The proposition, "I am the center," need never be uttered. It is the assumption upon which all certainty and all doubt turns. Agensis, the third analytic of men. See your enemies content and your lovers melancholy. Anani Proverb. Early summer, 4111, year of the Tusk, the fortress of Asgiliac. For the first time in living memory, an earthquake struck the Unara Spur and the Inunara Highlands. Hundreds of miles away, the great bustling markets of Gilgath fell silent as wares swung on their hooks and mortar chipped down shivering walls. Mules kicked, their eyes rolling in fear. Dogs howled. But in Asgiliac, the southern bulwark of the peoples of the Kyrene Plain since time immemorial, men were knocked to their knees, walls swayed like palm fronds, and the ancient citadel of Ruam, which had survived the kings of Shigek, the dragons of Tsuruma, and no less than three Fainim jihads, collapsed in a mighty column of dust. As the survivors pulled bodies from the debris, they found themselves grieving the stone more than the flesh. "Hard-hearted Ruam!" they cried out in disbelief. "The high bull of Asgiliac has fallen!" For many in the empire, Ruam was a totem. Not since the days of Ingushahrotep II, the ancient god-king of Shigek, had the citadel of Asgiliac been destroyed, the last time the south ever conquered the peoples of the Kyrene Plains. The first men of the Tusk, a troop of hard-riding Galioth horsemen under Coitha Sauban's nephew, Athgieri, arrived 4 days following. To their dismay, they found Asgiliac in partial ruin, and her battered garrison convinced of the holy war's doom. Nersey Proyas and his Conryans arrived the day after, to be followed 2 days after that by Icuri Confus and his imperial columns, as well as the Shrial Knights under Inkiri Gotian. Where Proyas had taken the Sogian way along the southern coast, then marched cross-country through the Inunara Highlands, Confus and Gotian had taken the so-called Forbidden Road, built by the Nansur to allow the quick deployment of their columns between the Fainim and Skilvendi frontiers. Of those great names who struck through the heart of the province, Coitha Sauban and his Galioth were the first to arrive, almost a full week after Confus. Gothyelk and his Tidoni appeared shortly after, followed by Skeelt and his grim Thunieri. Of the Anani, nothing was known, save that from the outset, their host, perhaps hampered by its ponderous size or by the scarlet spires and their vast baggage trains, had trouble making half the daily distance of the other contingents. So the greater portion of the Holy War made camp on the barren slopes beneath Asgiliac's ramparts and waited, trading rumors and premonitions of disaster. To the sentries posted on Asgiliac's walls, they looked like a migrating nation, like something from the Tusk. When it became apparent that days, perhaps weeks, might pass before the Anani joined them, Nersey Proyas called a council of the great and lesser names. Given the size of the assembly, they were forced to gather in Asgiliac's inner bailey, beneath the debris heaped about Ruam's broken foundations. The great names took their places about a salvaged trestle table, while the others, dressed in the finery of a dozen nations, sat across the rubble slopes, making an amphitheater of the ruin. They fairly shimmered in the bright sunlight. They spent most of the morning observing the proper rituals and sacrifices. This was the first full council since marching from Momum. The afternoon they spent quarreling, for the most part debating whether Ruam's destruction portended catastrophe or nothing at all. Sauban claimed that the holy war should break camp immediately, seize the passes of the southern gates, and march into Gedea. "This place oppresses us," he cried, gesturing to the tiers of ruin. "We slumber and stir in the shadow of dread." Ruam, he insisted, was a Nansur superstition, a shibboleth of the perfumed and the weak-hearted. The longer the holy war loitered beneath its ruin, the more it would become their superstition. If many saw sense in these arguments, many others saw madness. Without the Scarlet Spires, Icuri Confis reminded the Galioth prince, the Holy War would be at the mercy of the Kishorim. According to my uncle's spies, Scaurus has assembled all the grandees of Shigek and awaits us in Gadea. Who's to say the Kisharim aren't waiting with him? Proyas and his Skilvendi advisor, Neyur Ur-Skiotha, agreed. To march without the Einani was errant foolishness, but no amount of argument, it seemed, could sway Saban and his confederates. The sun smoldered over the western turrets, and they'd agreed on nothing save the obvious, such as dispatching riders to locate the Einani, or sending Athgieri into Gadea to gather intelligence. Otherwise, it seemed certain the Holy War, so recently reunited, would fracture once again. Proyas had fallen silent, his face buried in his hands. Only Confus continued to argue with Saban, if trading embittered insults could be called such. Then Anassarimber Kellis, the impoverished Prince of Atrithau, stood from his place among those watching and cried, "You mistake the meaning of what you see, all of you! The loss of Ruam is no accident, but neither is it a curse." Saban laughed, shouting, "Ruam is a talisman against the heathen, is it not?" "Yes," the Prince of Atrithau replied. "So long as the citadel stood, we could turn back. But now, don't you see? Just beyond these mountains, men congregate in the tabernacles of the false prophet. We stand upon the heathen shore, the heathen shore." He paused, looked at each great name in turn. "Without Ruam, there's no turning back. The god has burned our ships." Afterward, it was decided. The Holy War would await the Einani and the Scarlet Spires. Far from Asgiliach, in the centermost chamber of his great tent, Eleazarus, Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires, reclined in his chair, the one luxury he'd allowed himself for this mad journey. Beneath him, his body slaves washed his feet in steaming water. Three tripods illuminated the surrounding gloom. Smoke curled through the interior, casting shadows that resembled water-stained script along the bellied canvas. The journey hadn't been as hard as he'd feared, thus far. Nevertheless, evenings such as this always seemed to occasion an almost shameful relief. At first, he'd thought it was his age. More than 20 years had passed since his last journey abroad. Weary bones, he would think, watching his people laboring in evening light, hoisting tent and pavilion to the very horizon. Weary old bones. But when he recalled those years spent hiking from mission to mission, city to city, he realized that what he suffered now had nothing to do with weariness. He could remember lying beside his fire beneath the stars, no grand pavilion overhead, no silk pillows kissing his cheek, only hard ground and the humming exhaustion that comes when a traveler falls completely still. That had been weariness, but this, borne on litters, surrounded by dozens of bare-chested slaves? The relief he experienced every evening, he realized, had nothing to do with fatigue and everything to do with standing still, which was to say, with Shima. Great decisions, he reflected, were measured by their finality as much as by their consequences. Sometimes he could feel it like a palpable thing, the path not taken, that fork in history where the Scarlet Spires repudiated Mathanet's outrageous offer and watched the Holy War from afar. It didn't exist, and yet it lingered, the way a night of passion might linger in the entreating look of a slave. He saw it everywhere, in nervous silences, in exchanged glances, in Iacchus's unrelenting cynicism, in General Setpenares's scowl. And it seemed to mock him with promise, just as the path he now walked mocked him with threat. To join a holy war. Eleazarus dealt in unrealities, it was his trade. But the unreality of this, the Scarlet Spires here, was well nigh indigestible. The thought of it spawned ironies, not the ironies that cultured men, the Einani in particular, savored, but rather the ironies that reproduced themselves endlessly, that reduced all determination to shaking indecision. Add to this the accumulation of complications, the House Icuri plotting with the heathen, the Mandate playing some arcane Gnostic game every single spire's agent in Sumna uncovered and executed, even though they seemed secure enough before the Scarlet Spires set foot in the Empire, Even Mathenet, the great Shriya of the Thousand Temples, worked some dark angle. Small wonder Shaima oppressed him. Small wonder each night seemed a respite. Eleazarus sighed as Mayaza, his new favorite, kneaded his right foot with warmed oil.
No matter, he told himself. Regret is the opiate of fools.
He leaned his head back, watched the girl work through his eyelashes.
Mayaza,
he said softly, grinning at her modest smile.
Mayaza. Hanomanu Eleazarus,
she sighed in turn. Daring wench. The other slaves gasped in shock, then broke into giggles. Such a bad girl, Eleazarus thought. He leaned forward to scoop her into his arms, but the sight of a black-gowned usher kneeling on the carpets halted him. Someone wished to see him, obviously. Probably General Setpanares, with more complaints about the host's sloth, which were really complaints about the Scarlet Spire's sloth. So the Ainani would be the last to reach Asgiliac. What did it matter? Let them wait.
What is it?
He snapped. The young man raised his face. A petitioner has come, Grandmaster.
At this hour? Who?
The usher hesitated.
A magi of the Maisunse school, Grandmaster. One Scalatius.
Maisunse. Whores, all of them.
What does he want?
Eleazarus asked. Something churned in his gut. More complications.
He wouldn't say specifically, the usher replied. He says only that he's ridden hard from Momum to speak with you on a matter of great urgency.
Pandera,
Eleazarus spat.
Whore, delay him momentarily, then send him in.
After the man withdrew, Eleazarus had his body slaves dry his feet and bind his sandals. He then dismissed them. As the last slave hastened out, the man called Scalatius was escorted in by two armored Javra.
Leave us,
Eleazarus said to the warrior slaves. They bowed low, then also withdrew. From his seat, he studied the mercenary, who was clean-shaven in the Nansur fashion, dressed in the humble garments of a traveler, leggings, a plain brown smock, and leather sandals. He seemed to tremble, as well he should. He stood before no less than the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires.
This is most impertinent, my mercenary brother,
Eleazarus said.
There are channels for this kind of transaction.
Begging your pardon, Grand Master, but there are no channels for what I have to trade.
In a rush, he added, I'm a white sash paralogue of the Maisunse Order, Grand Master, contracted to the Imperial family as an auditor. The Emperor uses me, from time to time, to confirm certain determinations made by his imperial sake.
Eleazarus digested this, decided to be accommodating. Continue.
Should we discuss the fee?
A caste menial, of course. Suthenti. No appreciation of the game. But Jinan, as the Ainani were fond of saying, brooked no consent. If one man played, everyone played. Rather than reply, Eleazarus studied his long painted nails, polished them absently against his breast. He looked up as though caught in a small indiscretion, then studied the fool like one burdened by determinations of life and death. The conjunction of silence and scrutiny nearly undid the man. He clasped his shaking hands before him.
Forgive my eagerness, Grand Master,
Scalatius stammered, falling to his knees.
So often are knowledge and greed spurs to each other.
Well done. The man was not utterly devoid of wit.
Spurs, indeed, Eleazarus said. But perhaps you should let me decide which rides which.
Of course, Grand Master, but...
But nothing, whore. Out with it.
Of course, Grandmaster,
he said again.
It's the Phanum sorcerer priests, the Kisharum. They have a new kind of spy.
The dramatics were forgotten. Eleazarus leaned forward.
Tell me more.
Forgive me, Grandmaster, the man blurted. But I would be paid before speaking any further.
A fool, after all. Time was ever the scholar's most precious commodity.
Whore or not, the man should have known that. Eleazarus sighed, then spoke the first impossible word. His mouth and eyes burned as bright as phosphor.
No! Scalatius cried. Please, I'll speak. There's no need.
Eleazarus paused, though his arcane muttering continued to echo, as though thrown by walls not found in this world. The silence, when it did come, felt absolute.
On the eve before the Holy War marched from Momum, the man began. I was summoned to the catacombs to observe what was supposed to be, they said, the interrogation of a spy. Apparently the Emperor's prime counsel.
Scarce? Eleazarus exclaimed. A spy?
The Maisonse hesitated, licked his lips.
Not Scaeus. Someone masquerading as him, or something.
Eleazarus nodded.
You have my attention, Scalatius.
The Emperor himself was present at the interrogation. He demanded, quite stridently, that I contradict the findings of the Sake, that I tell him sorcery was involved. The Prime Council was, as you know, an old man, and yet he'd apparently killed or maimed several members of the Eothic Guard during his arrest. With his bare hands, they said. The Emperor was, well, overwrought.
So what did you see, Auditor? Did you see the mark?
No, nothing. He was unbruised. There was no sorcery whatsoever involved. But when I said as much to the Emperor, he accused me of conspiring with the Sake to overthrow him. Then the Mandate Schoolman arrived, escorted by Icuri Confis, not...
Mandate Schoolman? Eleazarus said. You mean Drusus Acamian?
Scalatius swallowed.
You know him. We, Maisonse, no longer bother with the Mandate. Does your eminence mean to...
Do you wish to sell knowledge, Scalatius, or trade it?
The Maisonse smiled nervously. Sell it, of course.
So then, what happened next?
The Mandati confirmed my determination, and the Emperor accused him of lying as well. As I said, the Emperor was...
overwrought.
Yes, even more so at this point. But the Mandati, Acamian, also seemed agitated. They argued.
Argued?
For some reason that didn't surprise Eleazarus.
About what?
The Maisonse shook his head.
I can't remember. Something about fear, I think. Then the Prime Council began speaking to the Mandati, in some language I've never heard. He recognized him.
Recognized? Are you sure?
Utterly. Scarce, or whatever it was, recognized Drusus Acamian. Then it began shaking. We just stood gaping. Then it wrenched its chains from the wall, freed itself.
Did Drusus Acamian assist him?
No. He was as horrified as the rest of us, if not more so. In the uproar, it killed two or three men. I've never seen anything move so fast. That was when the Sake intervened, burned him. Now that I think about it, burned him over the Mandati's objections. The man was wroth.
Acamian tried to intercede?
To the point of sheltering the Prime Council with his own body.
You're certain about that?
Absolutely. I'll never forget, because that was when the Prime Council's face... That was when his face... unpeeled.
Unpeeled?
Or unfolded, its face just opened, like fingers, but I know of no other way to describe it.
Like fingers?
This can't be.
He lies.
You doubt me. You mustn't, Your Eminence. This spy was a double, a mimic, without the mark. And that means he must be an artifact of the Tsuka, the Kisharum. It means they have spies you cannot see.
Numbness spilled like water from Eleazarus's chest to his limbs.
I've wagered my school. But their art is too crude.
Scalatius looked curiously heartened.
Nevertheless, it's the only explanation. They've found some way of creating perfect spies. Think, how long have they owned the Emperor's ear? The Emperor! Who knows how many?
He paused, apparently wary of speaking too close to the heart of the matter.
But this is why I rode so hard to find you, to warn you.
Eleazarus's mouth had become very dry.
He tried to swallow.
You must stay with us, of course, so that we can interview you further.
The man's face had become the very picture of dread.
I'm afraid that won't be possible, your eminence. I'm expected back at the Imperial Court.
Eleazarus clasped his hands to conceal the tremors.
You work for the Scarlet Spires now, Scalatius. Your contract with House Aikyori is dissolved.
Ah, your eminence, as much as I abase myself before your glory and power, I am your slave. I fear that my Sunsei contracts cannot be dissolved by fiat, not even yours. So if I could collect my...
Ah, yes, your fee.
Eleazarus stared hard at the Maisunsei, smiled with deceptive mildness. Poor fool, to think he'd underestimated the value of his information. This was worth far more than gold, far more. The Maisunsei's face had gone blank.
I suppose I could delay my departure.
At that point, Eleazarus almost died. The man had started his cant the instant of Eleazarus's reply, purchasing a heartbeat's advantage. Almost enough. Lightning cut the air, skipped and thundered across the Grand Master's reflexive wards. Momentarily blinded, Eleazarus tipped back in his chair and tumbled across the carpeted ground. He was singing before he found his knees. The air danced with hammering lights, flurries of burning sparrows. The fool cried out, sputtered as best he could, trying to reinforce his wards. But for Hanumanu Eleazarus, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires, he was little more than a child's riddle, easily solved. Bird after fiery bird swept into him, immolation after immolation, battering his wards to ruin. Then chains flashed from corners of empty air, piercing limbs and shoulders, crossing as though looped between a child's fingers until the man hung suspended, threaded. Scalatius screamed. Javra charged into the room, weapons drawn, only to halt, horror-stricken, before the spectacle of the Maisunsei. Eleazarus barked at them to leave. He glimpsed his master of spies, Iacchus, fighting his way past the retreating warrior slaves. The canv addict fairly tumbled across the carpets, his red irised eyes wide, his bruised lips agog. Eleazarus couldn't recall seeing such passion in the man's expression, at least not since the Kishorim's fateful attack 10 years before. Their declaration of war.
Eli!
Iacchus cried, staring at Scalatius's impaled and writhing form.
What's this?
The Grand Master absently stamped at a small fire burning on the carpets.
A gift to you, old friend. Another enigma for you to interpret. Another threat.
Threat?
The man cried.
What's the meaning of this, Eli? What's happened here?
Eleazarus studied the screaming Maisunsei, a scholar distracted by his work.
What do I do?
That mandate schoolman,
Eleazarus snapped, turning to Iacchus.
Where's he now?
Marching with Proyas, or so I assume. Eli, tell me.
Drusus Akamian must be brought to me,
Eleazarus continued.
Brought to me or killed?
Iacchus's expression darkened.
Something like that requires time, planning. He's a mandate schoolman, Eli. Not to mention the risk of reprisals. What, do we war against both the Kishorim and the Mandate? Either way, nothing will be done until I know what's going on. It is my right.
Eleazarus studied the man, matched his unsettling gaze. For perhaps the first time he felt comforted rather than chilled by his translucent skin.
Iacchus, it has to be you, doesn't it? This must seem,
he said, irrational.
Indeed, mad even.
Trust me, old friend, it's not. Need makes all things rational.
Why this evasion?
Iacchus cried.
Patience, Eleazarus replied, gathering with his wind the dignity which behooved a grand master.
This was an occasion for control, calculation.
First you must humor my madness, Iacchus, and then let me recount the grounds that make it sane. First you must let me handle your face.
And why is that?
The man asked. Astonishment. From what seemed a distant place, Scalatius wailed.
I must know that there are bones beneath. Proper bones.
For the first time since leaving Momum, Akamian found himself alone with the evening fire. Proyas was hosting a temple fete for the other great names, and everyone, save the sorcerer and the slaves, had been invited. So Akamian had decided to host a celebration of his own. He drank to the sun, which leaned against the shoulders of the Unaris Spur, to Asgiliak and her broken towers, and to the encamped Holy War, her innumerable fires glittering in the dusk. He drank until his head drooped before the flames, until his thoughts became a slurry of arguments, pleas, and regrets. Telling Kellis about his dilemma, he now knew, had been rash. 2 weeks had passed since his confession. During this time, the Kenryan contingent had abandoned the stone of the Sogian Way for the scrub and sandy slopes of the Yinunata Highlands. He had walked with Kellis much as before, answering his questions, pondering his remarks, and wondering, always wondering, at the heart and intellect of the man. On the surface, everything was the same, save the lack of a road to follow, but beneath, everything had changed. He'd thought sharing would ease his burden, that honesty would absolve his shame. How could he be such a fool, thinking that the secrecy of his dilemma had caused his anguish rather than the dilemma? If anything, secrecy had been a balm. Now, every time he and Kellis exchanged glances, Akamian saw his anguish reflected and reproduced, until at times it seemed he couldn't breathe. Far from lessening his burden, he doubled it. What, Kellis had subsequently asked, will the mandate do if you tell them? Take you to Adyrsis? Confine you? Interrogate you? Now that they know the consult runs amok, they'll do anything to exercise the semblance of control. For that reason alone, they'd never let you go. Then you mustn't tell them, Akka. There had been an anger and an anxiousness to these words, a cross desperation that reminded him of Inrau. And the second apocalypse, what about that? But are you sure? Sure enough to wager an entire life? A life for the world, or the world for a life? You don't understand. The stakes, Kellis. Think of what's at stake. How, Kellis had replied, can I think of anything else? The cultic priestesses of Yatwer, Akamian had once heard, always dragged two victims, usually spring lambs, to the sacrificial altar, one to pass under the knife, the other to witness the sacred passage. In this way, every beast thrown upon the altar always knew, in its dim way, what was about to happen. For the Yatwerians, ritual wasn't enough. The transformation of casual slaughter into true sacrifice required recognition. One lamb for 10 bulls, a priestess had told him once, as though she possessed the calculus to measure such things. One lamb for 10 bulls. At the time, Akamian had laughed. Now he understood. Before, the dilemma had overwhelmed in a harried, flinching way, like some secret perversion. But now that Kellis knew, it simply overwhelmed. Before, Akamian could find respite from time to time in the man's remarkable company. He could pretend to be a simple teacher. But now, the dilemma had become something between them, something always there, whether Akamian averted his eyes or not. There was no more pretending, no more forgetting, only the knife of inaction. And wine, sweet unwatered wine. When they'd arrived at half-ruined Asgiliak, Akamian began, more out of desperation than anything else, teaching Kellis algebra, geometry, and logic. What better way to impose clarity on soul-bruising confusion, certainty on rib-gnawing doubt? While the others watched from nearby, laughing, scratching their heads, or in the Skelvendi's case, glowering, Akamian and Kellis spent hours scratching proofs across the bare earth. Within days, the Prince of Atrathau was improvising new axioms, discovering theorems and formulae that Akamian had never imagined possible, let alone encountered in the classic texts. Kellis even proved to him, proved, that the logic of Agensis as laid out in the syllogistics was preceded by a more basic logic, one which used relations between entire sentences rather than subjects and predicates. 2,000 years of comprehension and insight overturned by the strokes of a stick across dust. How? He cried. How? Kellis shrugged. This is simply what I see.
He's here, Akamian had thought absurdly, but he doesn't stand beside me. If all men saw from where they stood, then Kellis stood somewhere else. That much was undeniable. But did he stand beyond the pale of Drusus Akamian's judgment? Ah, the question. More drink was required. Akamian rooted through his satchel, his only fireside companion, and withdrew the map he'd sketched, so long ago it now seemed, while journeying from Sumna to Momum. He held it to the firelight, blinked several bleary times. All of them, every name scratched in black, was connected, except for Anassa Rimbert Kellis. Relations. Like arithmetic or logic, it all came down to relations. Akamian had inked those relations he knew without a doubt, such as the link between the consult and the emperor, and even those he simply assumed or feared, such as that between Mathenet and Inrau. Ink lines, one for the consult infiltration of the imperial court, another for Inrau's murder, another for the Scarlet Spire's war against the Kisharim, another for the Holy War's reconquest of Shaima, and so on. Ink lines for relations, a thin skeleton of black. But where did Kellis fit? Where? Akamian suddenly cackled, resisted the urge to throw the parchment into the fire. Smoke. Wasn't that what relations were in truth? Not ink, but smoke. Hard to see and impossible to grasp. And wasn't that the problem? The problem with everything? The thought of smoke brought Akamian to his feet. He swayed for a moment, then bent to retrieve his satchel. Again, he debated tossing the map into the flames, but thought better of it. He was a veteran of many drunken blunders and stuffed the parchment back with his things. With his satchel and Zynemus's wineskin slung over opposite shoulders, he stumbled off into the darkness, laughing to himself and thinking, yes, smoke. I need smoke. Hashish. Why not? The world was about to end. As the sun set behind the Unada Spur, each point of firelight became a circle of illumination until the encampment became gold coins scattered across black cloth. Among the first to arrive, the Cunrians had pitched their pavilions on the heights immediately below Asgiliac and its ready supply of water. As a result, Akamian traveled down, always down, into what seemed an ever darker and more raucous underworld. He walked and stumbled, exploring the shadowy arteries between pavilions. He passed many others, groups carousing from camp to camp, drunks searching for latrines, slaves on errands, even a Gilgalic priest chanting and swinging the carcass of a hawk from a leather string. From time to time he slowed, stared at the ruddy faces crowded about each fire, laughed at their antics, or pondered their scowls. He watched them strut and posture, beat their breasts and bellow at the mountains. Soon they would descend upon the heathen. Soon they would close with their hated foe. The god has burned our ships, Akamian heard one bare-chested Galioth roar, first in Shaic, then in his native tongue.
Wasen het vota grefirsa.
Periodically, he paused to search the darkness behind him. Old habit. After a time, he found himself weary and nearly out of wine. He'd trusted fate, Anagke, to take him to the camp followers. She was, after all, called the whore. But as with everything else, she'd led him astray, the fucking whore. He began daring the light to find directions.
Wrong way, friend,
an older man, missing his front teeth, told him at one camp.
Only mules rotting here. Oxen and mules.
Good, Akamian said, clutching his groin in the familiar Tidoni manner. At least the proportions will be right. The old man and his comrades burst into laughter. Akamian winked and tipped back his wineskin.
Then that way,
some wit called from the fire, pointing to the darkness beyond.
I hope your ass has deep pockets.
Akamian coughed wine from his nose, then spent several moments bent over, hacking. The general merriment this caused won him a place by their fire. An inveterate traveler, Akamian was accustomed to the company of warlike strangers, and for a time he enjoyed their companionship, their wine, and his own anonymity.
but when their questions became too pointed, he thanked them and took his leave. Drawn by the throb of drums, Akamian crossed a portion of the camp that seemed deserted, then, quite without warning, found himself in the precincts of the camp followers. Suddenly, all the activity seemed concentrated between the fires. With every step, he bumped some shoulder, pressed some back. In some places, he pressed through crowds in almost total darkness, with only heads, shoulders, and the odd face frosted by the nail of heaven's pale light. In others, torches had been hammered into the earth, either for musicians, merchants, or leather-paneled brothels. Several avenues even boasted hanging lanterns. He saw young men of the Tusk, no more than boys, really, vomiting from too much drink. He saw 10-year-old girls drawing thick-waisted warriors behind curtained canopies. He even glimpsed a boy wearing smeared cosmetics who watched with fearful promise as man after man passed. He saw craftsmen manning stalls, walked past more than a few impromptu smithies. Beneath the rambling canopies of an opium den, he saw men twitch as though beset by flies. He passed the gilded pavilions of the cults. Gilgeol, Yatwar, Momus, Ajokli, even elusive Ankus, who'd been Inrao's passion, as well as innumerable others. He waved away the ever-present beggars and laughed at the adepts who pressed clay blessing tablets into his hands. For tracts of his journey, Akamian saw no tents at all, only rough shelters improvised from sticks, twine, and painted leather, or in some cases, a simple mat. While wandering one alley, Akamian saw no less than a dozen couples, male and female, or male and male, rutting in plain view. Once he paused to watch an improbably beautiful Norserai girl gasp between the exertions of two men, only to be accosted by a black-toothed man with a stick demanding coin. Afterward, he watched an ancient tattooed hermit try to force himself on a fat drab. He saw black-skinned Zayumi harlots dancing in their strange, puppet-limbed manner and dressed in gaudy gowns of false silk, caricatures of the ornate elegance that so characterized their faraway land. The first woman found him more than the other way around. As he walked through a particularly gloomy alley between canvas shanties, he heard a rattle, then felt small hands groping for his groin from behind. When he turned and embraced her, she seemed shapely enough, though he could see little of her face in the dark. She was already rubbing his manhood through his robe, murmuring, "Just a copper, lord, just a copper for your sheed." He could sense her sour smile. "Two coppers for my peach. Do you want my peach?" Almost despite himself, he leaned into her whisking hands, gasped. Then a file of torch-bearing cavalrymen, Imperial Kidrahil, rumbled by and he glimpsed her face, vacant eyes and ulcerated lips. He pressed her back, fumbling for his purse. He fished out a copper, meant to hand it to her, but fumbled it onto the ground instead. She fell to her knees, started combing the blackness, grunting. Akamian fled. A short time after, he found himself prowling the darkness, watching a group of prostitutes about their fire. They sang and clapped while a wanton, flat-chested Ketche woman pranced around the flames, wearing only a blanket that reached her hips. This was a common custom, Akamian knew. They would each take turns, dancing lewdly and calling out into the surrounding blackness, declaring their wares and their station. He reviewed the women from the shelter of darkness first, so as to avoid the embarrassment of choosing in their presence. The girl who danced didn't appeal to him, too much of a horse's mien. But the young Norserai girl, who rolled her pretty face to the song like a child, she sat on the ground with her knees haphazardly before her, the firelight chancing upon her inner thighs. When he finally walked into their midst, they began shouting like slavers at auction, offering promises and praise that became mockery the instant he took the Galioth girl by the hand. Despite the drink, he felt so nervous he could barely breathe. She looked so beautiful, so soft and unspoiled. Picking a candle from a small row of votives, she pulled him into the blackness, led him to the last in a row of crude shelters. She shed her blanket and crawled beneath the stained leather. Akamian stood above her, panting, wanting to breathe deep the pale glory of her naked form. The far wall of her shelter, however, consisted of little more than rags knotted into ropes. Through it, he could see hundreds of people pressing in this direction and that through a shadowy thoroughfare.
You won't fuck me, yes?
She said as though nothing could be amiss.
Oh, yes,
he mumbled. Where had his breath gone?
Sweet Sejanus. Fuck me many time, eh, Baswat?
He laughed nervously, peered through the rag curtain once again. Two men were cursing at each other, scuffling near enough to make a commune flinch.
Many times,
he replied, knowing this to be the polite way to discuss price. How many do you think?
Think four silver times.
Silver? Obviously, she'd confused his embarrassment for inexperience. Even still, what was money on a night like this? He celebrated, didn't he? He shrugged, saying, an old man like me? In this particular language, the man was forced to deride his own prowess in order to strike a fair bargain. If he was poor, he complained of being old, infirm, and so on. Arrogant men, Esmonette had told him once, usually fared poorly in these negotiations, which, of course, was the point. Harlots hated nothing more than men who arrived already, believing the flattering lies they would tell them. Esme called them the Simusterapari, or those who spit twice. The Galeoth girl studied him with nebulous eyes. She'd started petting herself in the gloom.
You're so strong, she said, suddenly thick-tongued. Like Baswat, strong. Two silver times, think?
Akamian laughed, tried hard not to watch her fingers. The ground had started a slow spin. For an instant, she looked pale and skinny in the dark, like an abused slave. The mat beneath her looked rough enough to cut her skin. He'd drunk too much.
Not too much. Just enough.
The ground steadied. He swallowed, nodded his agreement, then pulled the two coins from his purse.
What does Baswat mean? He asked, slipping the silver into her small, waiting palm.
Hmm?
She replied, smiling triumphantly. She stashed the two white shining talents with startling swiftness. What would she buy, he wondered, then looked back at him with large questioning eyes.
What does that mean? He repeated more slowly. Baswat.
She frowned, then giggled.
For Big Bear.
She was full-breasted, mature, but something about her manner reminded him of a little girl. The guileless smile, the rolling eyes and bouncing chin, the knees opening and closing like butterfly wings. A commune half expected a scolding mother to come barging between them. Was that part of the pantomime as well, like the shameless banter? His heart hammered. He knelt where her toys should have been between her legs. She squirmed and writhed as though the threat of his mere presence would make her climax.
Fuck me, Baswat, she gasped. Baswat, fuck me, fuck me, fuck me. Please.
He swayed, caught himself, chuckled. He began hitching up his robe, glanced nervously at the shadowy stream of passers-by through the curtain. They walked so close he could spit on their shins. He tried to ignore the smell, his smell.
Ooh, such Big Bear,
she cooed, stroking his cock. Suddenly, his apprehension melted away, and some deranged part of him actually exulted in the thought of others watching. Let them watch. Let them learn. Always the teacher. Cackling, he seized her narrow hips, pulled her across his thighs. How he'd yearned for this moment, to have license with a stranger. It seemed there could be nothing so sweet as a fresh peach. He was trembling, trembling. She moaned silver, cried gold, faces turned in the passing crowd. Through the knotted rags, Akamian saw Esmonette.
Esme!
Akamian hollered, barreling through arms and shoulders. The Galeoth girl was crying out something behind him, some gibberish. He glimpsed Esmonette again, hurrying along a row of torches that fronted the canopies of a Yatwarian lazarette. A tall man, sporting the matted braids of a Thunyeri warrior, held her arm, but she seemed to be leading.
Esme!
He cried, jumping to be seen above the screens of people. She didn't turn.
Esme, stop!
Why would she run? Had she seen him with the drab? For that matter, what would she be doing here?
Damn it, Esmonette, it's me! Me!
Did she glance back? It was too dark to tell. For a heartbeat, he debated using sorcery. He could blind the entire quarter if he wished. But as always, he could sense the small points of death scattered throughout the surrounding crowds, men of the Tusk bearing their hereditary core. He redoubled his efforts, began lunging through the mobs. Someone struck him, hard enough to leave his ears ringing, but he didn't care.
Esme!
He glimpsed her pulling the Thunieri into an even darker byway. He stumbled free of what seemed the last thicket of people, then sprinted to the mouth of the alley. He hesitated before plunging into the blackness, struck by a sudden premonition of disaster.
Hesmanette, here, in the Holy War? There was no way.
A trap. A thought like a knife. The ground had resumed spinning. If the consult could fashion a Scaeus, couldn't they fashion an Esmanette as well? If they knew about Inrau, then they almost certainly knew about her. What better way to gall a heartsick schoolman than to... A skin spy? Do I chase a skin spy? In his soul's eye, he saw Gishruni's corpse pulled from the river Sayot. Murdered. Desecrated.
Sweet Sejanus, they took his face. Could the same have happened? Esme!
He cried, charging into the darkness.
Esme! Esme!
Miraculously, she paused with her escort in the light of a single torch, either alarmed by his cries or... A Commian staggered to a stop before her, utterly dumbstruck. He reeled. It wasn't her. The brown eyes were smaller, the cheeks too high. Almost, but no. Almost, Esmanette.
Another madman, the woman snorted to her companion. I thought,
a Commian murmured.
I thought you were someone else.
Poor girl, she sneered, turning her back.
No, wait, please.
Please what? A Commian blinked at his tears.
She looked so close.
I need you, he whispered. I need your comfort. Without warning, the Thunieri seized him by the throat, hammered him in the gut.
Kundraut,
the man bellowed.
Parasafal ferotin kundatus.
Winded, a Commian coughed and clawed at the man's massive forearm. Panic. Then gravel and rock. Ground slammed against his chest and cheek. Concussion. Bright blackness. Someone screaming. The taste of blood. A dim image of the wild-haired warrior spitting on him. He convulsed, rolled to his side, sobbed, then pressed himself to his knees. Through tears, he saw their retreating backs disappear in thickets of people.
Esme!
He bawled.
Esmanette! Please!
Such an old-fashioned name.
Esme! Come back!
Then he felt the touch, heard the voice. Still fetching sticks, I see, tired old dog. Glimpses of menace by torchlight. Her slender arms bracing him, they stumbled through a gallery of darkling faces. She smelled of camphor and the oil of sesame, like a Phaenum merchant. Could that be her smell?
Sweet Seja, Akka, you're a mess.
Esme?
Yes, it's me, Akka, me.
Your face?
Some Galioth ingrate.
Bitter laugh. That's the way it is with men of the Tusk and their whores. If you can't fuck them, beat them.
Oh, Esme. Once the swelling starts, I'll look a cast noble virgin compared to you. Did you hear me scream when he kicked you in the face? What were you doing?
I'm not sure.
Looking for you.
Shh, Akash. Not here. After.
Just say it. My name, just say it.
Drusus Akamian. Akka. And he wept, so hard that at first he didn't realize she wept with him. Perhaps driven by the same impulse, they retreated into the blackness behind a dark pavilion, fell to their knees, and embraced.
It's really you,
a Commian murmured, seeing twin moons reflected in her wet eyes. She laughed and sobbed.
Really me?
His lips burned with the salt of mingled tears. He pulled her left breast free of her hassas, began circling her nipple with his thumb.
Why did you leave Sumna? I was afraid,
she whispered, kissing his forehead and cheeks.
Why am I always afraid?
Because you breathe. A passionate kiss, hands fumbling in the blackness, tugging, clutching. The ground spun. He leaned back and she hooked burning thighs about his waist. Then he was inside and she gasped. They sat motionless for several heartbeats, throbbing together, exchanging shallow breaths.
Never again,
Akamian said.
Promise?
She wiped at her face, sniffled. He began slowly rocking her.
Promise. Nothing.
No man, no school, no threat. Nothing will take you from me again.
Nothing,
she moaned. For a time, they seemed one being, dancing about the same delirious burn, swaying from the same breathless center. For a time, they felt no fear. Afterward, they exchanged caresses and whispered sweet words in the darkness, apologies offered for things already forgiven. Eventually, Akamian asked her where she kept her belongings.
I've already been robbed, she said, trying to smile. But I have a few things left,
not far from here.
Will you stay with me?
He asked with tearful earnestness.
Can you?
He watched her swallow, blink.
I can.
He laughed, pushed himself to his feet.
Then let's get your things.
Even in the gloom, he could see the terror in her eyes. She hugged her shoulders as though reminding herself not to fly away, then slipped her hand into his waiting palm. They walked slowly, like lovers strolling through a bazaar. Periodically, Akamian would stare into her eyes and laugh in disbelief.
I thought you were gone, he said once. But I've always been here.
Rather than ask what she meant, Akamian simply smiled. For the moment, her mysteries didn't matter. He wasn't so fool drunk as to think nothing was amiss. Something had driven her from Sumna. Something had led her to the Holy War. Something had compelled her, yes, to avoid him. But for the moment, none of this mattered. He cared only that she was here.
Just let this night last. Please give me this one night.
They chatted effortlessly about effortless things, joking about this or that passerby, telling stories about the curious things they'd seen in the Holy War. The unspoken regions between them were well marked, and for the moment, they steered each other clear of painful boundaries. They paused to watch a mummer dip a leather rope into a basket filled with scorpions. When he pulled it clear, it seethed with chitinous limbs, pincers, and stabbing tails. This, the man proclaimed, was the famed scorpion braid, which the kings of Nil-Namesh still used to punish mortal crimes. When the audience encircled him, anxious for a closer look, he raised the braid high for everyone to see, then suddenly began swinging it over their heads. Women screamed, men ducked or raised their hands, but not a single scorpion flew from the rope. The rope, the mummer cried over the commotion, was soaked in a poison that seized the scorpion's jaws. Without the antidote, he said, they would remain locked to the leather until they died. For much of the demonstration, Akamian watched and delighted in Esmanet's expression, all the while wondering that she could seem so new. He found himself discovering things he'd never before noticed. The dusting of freckles across her nose and cheeks, the extraordinary white of her eyes, the smattering of auburn through her luxurious black hair, the athletic slope of her back and shoulders, everything about her, it seemed, possessed a bewitching novelty.
I must always see her like this, as the stranger I love.
Each time their glances met, they laughed as though celebrating a fortuitous reunion, but they always looked away, as though knowing their momentary bliss wouldn't bear examination. Then something, a flicker of anxiousness, perhaps, passed between them, and they ceased looking at each other altogether. A sudden hollow opened in the heart of Akamian's elation. He clutched her hand for reassurance, but she left her fingers slack. After several moments, Esmanet tugged him to a stop in the light of several bright burning pots. She stared into his face, expressionless, save for the hard set of her jaw.
Something's different, she said. Before, you could always pretend, even when Inrao died. But now, Something's different. What's happened?
He shied from answering her. It was too soon.
I'm a mandate schoolman, he said lamely. What can I say? We all suffer.
She fixed him with a canny scowl.
Knowledge, she said. You all suffer knowledge. If you suffer more, it means you've learned more. Is that it? Have you learned more?
Akamian stared straight ahead, said nothing.
It was too soon.
She looked past him, sorted through the shadowy crowds.
Would you like to hear what's happened to me?
Leave it be, Esme.
She flinched, turned away, blinking. She pulled her hand free and resumed walking.
Esme, he said, following her. You know, she said, it hasn't been bad, save the odd beating. Plenty of custom, plenty of—
That's enough, Esme. She laughed, acted as if she were engaged in a different, more frank conversation.
I've even lain with lords, cast nobles, Akka, imagine. Even their cocks are bigger. Did you know that?
I wouldn't know about the Einani. They seem to prefer boys. And the Conryans? They flock about the Galios, sluts. All that milk-white skin, you know. But the Columns, the Nansur, they like their peaches homegrown, though they rarely stray from the military brothels. And the Thunieri, they can scarce bridle their seed when my knees flop open. Brutes, though, especially when they're drunk. Stingy bastards, too. Oh, and the Galioth? There's a treat. They complain I'm too skinny, but they love my skin. If it weren't for the guilt and anger afterward, they'd be my favorites. They're not accustomed to whores. Not enough old cities in their country, I think. Not enough barter.
She studied Akamian, her look both bitter and shrewd. He walked, his eyes welded forward.
Custom has been good, she said, looking away.
The old rage had returned, the one that had driven him from her arms months before. He clenched his fists, saw himself shaking her, striking her. Fucking whore! He wanted to scream.
Why tell him this? Why tell him what he couldn't bear to hear? Especially when she had her own things to answer for. Why did you leave Sumna? How long have you been hiding from me? How long?
But before he could say anything, she veered from the armed throngs and walked toward a fire surrounded by painted faces. More harlots.
Esme!
A dark-haired woman called out in a brusque, even mannish voice.
Who's your—
She paused, getting a better look, then laughed.
Who's your hapless friend?
She was stout-limbed and thick-waisted, but without being fat, the kind of woman Esme had told him once, prized by certain Norserai men. Akamian immediately recognized her as someone who confused ill manners with daring. Esmanette halted, hesitated long enough to make Akamian frown.
This is Akka.
The drab's heavy eyebrows popped up.
The infamous Drusus Akamian?
The woman said.
The schoolman?
Akamian looked to Esmanette. Who was this woman?
This is Yaselis,
Esmanette said, speaking the woman's name as though it explained everything.
Yassi.
Yaselis's appraising stare remained fixed on Akamian.
So, what are you doing here, Akka?
He shrugged, saying, I follow the Holy War.
The same as us,
Yaselis exclaimed.
Though you might say we march for a different tusk.
The other prostitutes burst out laughing, like men.
And the little prophet,
another said, her voice hoarse.
Good for only one sermon.
All the women howled, with the exception of Yassi, who only smiled. More jokes followed, but Esmanette was already pulling him into the darkness toward what must have been her shelter.
All of us camp in bands, she said, preempting any questions or observations. We watch out for one another.
So I gathered.
This is mine,
she said, kneeling before the greased canvas flaps of a low-wedged tent not so unlike his own. Akamian found himself relieved. Without a word, she crawled into the blackness. Akamian followed. Within, there was barely enough room to sit upright. Beneath the incense, the air smelled of rutting, if only because Akamian couldn't stop imagining her with her men. She disrobed in the routine manner of a harlot, and he studied her lithe, small-breasted silhouette. She looked so frail in the remains of the firelight, so small and desolate,
The thought of her pinioned here night after night, beneath man after man. I must make this right. Do you have a candle? He asked. Some, but we'll be burned.
Fire was the perennial fear of those raised in cities.
No, he replied. Never with me.
She withdrew a candle from a bundle in the corner, and Akamian ignited it with a word. In Sumna, she'd always marveled at such tricks. Now she simply regarded him with a kind of resigned wariness. They both blinked in the light. She drew a stained blanket across her lap, stared vacantly at the snarl of coverings between them. He swallowed.
Esme, why tell me all that?
Because I had to know,
she replied, looking down at her hands.
Know what? What makes my hand shake? What makes my eyes dart in terror?
Her shoulders hitched in the gloom. Akamian realized she was sobbing.
You pretended I wasn't there,
she whispered.
I what?
That last night at Momum. I came to you. I watched your camp, your friends, only hidden because I was too afraid that I would... But you weren't there, Akka. So I waited and waited. Then I saw you. I wept with joy, Akka, wept. I stood there, right before you, weeping. I held out my arms, and you.
The anguished light in her eyes dulled, flickered out. She finished in a different voice, far colder.
You pretended I wasn't there.
What was she talking about? Akamian pressed palms to his forehead, wrestled with the urge to lash out, to punish. She stood close enough to touch, after all this time, and yet she receded. He needed to understand.
Esme, he said slowly, trying to collect his wine-addled wits.
What are you?
What was it, Akka?
She asked, rigid and cool.
Was I too polluted? Too defiled? Too much a filthy whore?
No, Esme, I...
Too bruised a peach?
Esmanette, listen to...
She laughed bitterly.
So you're going to take me to your tent, you say? Add me to the bushel?
He seized her by the shoulders, crying,
You speak of bushels to me? You?
But he immediately repented, seeing his own savagery reflected in her terrified expression. She had even flinched, as though expecting a blow. He noticed, as though for the first time, the bruising about her left eye.
Who did this? Not me, not me.
Look at us,
he said, releasing her and carefully drawing back his hands, both beaten, both outcasts.
Look at us,
she mumbled, tears spilling down her cheeks.
I can explain, Esme, everything.
She nodded, rubbed her shoulders where he'd grabbed her. Female voices chimed in unison outside. They had started singing like the other harlots, promising soft thighs for hard silver. Firelight glittered through the open flaps, like gold through dark waters.
That night you're talking about. Sweet Sejanus, Esme, if I didn't see you, it wasn't because I was ashamed of you. How could I be? How could anyone, let alone a sorcerer, be ashamed of a woman such as you?
She bit her lip. Smiled through more tears.
Then why?
Akamian rolled to his side and laid next to her, his eyes searching the dark canvas above.
Because I found them, Esme. That very night, I found the consult.
I remember nothing after that, he concluded. I know I walked through the night. All the way from the Imperial precincts to Zynemus's camp, but I remember none of it. The words had splashed from him, an inarticulate rush painting the horrific events that transpired that night beneath the Endymion Heights. The unprecedented summons, the meeting with Icuri Zarius III, the interrogation of Scaeus, his prime counsel, the face that was not a face, unclenching like a woman's long-fingered fist, the dreadful conspiracy of skin. He told her about everything, except Kellis.
Esmanette had curled into his arms to listen. Now she perched her chin on his chest.
Did the Emperor believe you?
No. I imagine he thinks the Kisharim were responsible. Men prefer new loves and old enemies.
And at Yersus?
What of the mandate?
Excited and dismayed in equal measure, or so I imagine. He licked his lips. I'm not sure. I haven't contacted them since first reporting to Nocera. They probably think I'm dead by now, murdered because of what I know.
Then they haven't contacted you?
That's not the way it works, remember?
Yes, yes, she replied, rolling her eyes and smirking. How does it go? With the chance of calling, you need to know both the here, the individual, and the there, the location, to initiate contact. Since you march, they have no idea where you are.
Exactly, he said, bracing himself for the inevitable question to follow. Her eyes probed his, compassionate, yet guarded.
So then why haven't you contacted them?
Akamian shuddered. He ran shaking fingers through her hair.
I'm so glad you're here, he murmured. So glad you're safe. Akka, what is it? You're frightening me.
He closed his eyes, breathed deep.
I met someone. Someone whose coming was foretold 2,000 years ago.
He opened his eyes and she was still there.
An Anasorimber.
But that means...
Esmonet frowned, stared into his chest.
You cried out that name in your sleep once, woke me.
She looked up, peered into his face.
I remember asking you what it meant, Anasorimber, and you said...
I don't remember.
You said that it named the last ruling dynasty of ancient Kunaiori, and...
Her expression slackened in horror.
This isn't funny, Akka. You're really scaring me.
She feared Akamian realized because she believed. He gasped, blinked hot tears, tears of joy.
She really believes. All along she's believed. No, Akka,
Esmonet cried, clutching his chest.
This can't be happening.
How could life be so perverse that a mandate schoolman could celebrate the world's end? With Esmonet pressed naked against him, he explained why he thought Kellis, without any doubt, had to be the harbinger. She listened without comment, watched him with a fearful expectancy.
Don't you see?
He said, as much to the surrounding darkness as to her.
If I tell Nocera and the others, they will take him, no matter whose protection he enjoys.
Will they kill him?
Akamian blinked away disturbing images of past interrogations.
They'll break him, murder who he is.
Even still, she said, Akka, you must surrender him.
There was no hesitation, no pause, only cold eyes and remorseless judgment. For women, it seemed, the scales of threat and love brooked no counterweights.
But this is a life, Esme.
Exactly, she replied. A life. What difference does it make, the life of one man? So many die, Akka.
The hard logic of a hard world.
It depends on the man, doesn't it?
This gave her pause.
I suppose it does, she said.
So, what kind of man is he?
What kind of man is worth risking apocalypse?
Despite her sarcasm, he could tell she feared his answer. Certainty despised complications, and she needed to be certain.
She thinks she saves me, he realized. She needs me to be wrong for my sake.
He's... Akamian swallowed.
He's unlike any other man.
How so?
A prostitute's skepticism.
It's difficult to explain.
He hesitated, pondering his time with Kellis. So many insights, so many instants of awe.
You know how it feels when you stand on someone else's ground, on their property?
I suppose. Like a trespasser or a guest?
Somehow that's the way he makes you feel. Like a guest.
An expression of distaste.
I'm not sure I like the sound of that.
Then it's not how it sounds.
Akamian breathed deeply, groped for the proper words.
There's many, many grounds between men. Some are mutual and some are not. When you and I speak of the consult, for instance, you stand upon my ground, just as I stand upon your ground when you discuss your life. But with Kellis, it makes no difference what you discuss or where you stand. Somehow, the ground beneath your feet belongs to him. I'm always his guest, always, even when I teach him, Esme.
You teach him? You've taken him as your student? Akamian frowned. She made it sound like a betrayal.
Just the exoterics, he said with a shrug. The world, not the esoterics. He's not one of the few. Almost as an afterthought, he added, thank the god.
Why do you say that?
Because of his intellect, Esme. You've no idea. I've never met such a subtle soul, neither in life nor in book. Not even a Gensis, Esme. A Gensis. If Kellas possessed the ability to work sorcery, he'd be...
Akamian caught his breath.
What? Another Seswatha. More than Seswatha.
Then I like him even less. He sounds dangerous, Akka. Let Nozera and the others know. If they seize him, so be it. At least you can wash your hands of this madness.
Fresh tears welled in his eyes. But, Akka, she pressed, this burden isn't yours to bear.
But it is.
Esmanette pushed herself from his chest, propping herself with an arm to lean over him. Her hair draped over her left shoulder, an impenetrable black in the candlelight. She seemed watchful, hesitant.
Is it?
I think you say this because of Inrao. Cold clasped his heart.
Inrao, sweet boy, son.
And why not?
He cried with sudden ferocity.
They killed him!
But they sent you! They sent you to Sumna to turn Inrao, and that's what you did, even though you knew exactly what would happen. You told me this before you even contacted him.
So what are you saying? That I killed Inrao?
I'm saying that's what you think. You think you killed him.
Oh, Akamian, her tone said. Please.
And what if I do? Does that mean I should relent a second time? Let those fools and Atyrsis doom another man that I...
No, Akamian. It means you're not doing this, any of this, to save this Anasarimber Kellas. You're doing it to punish yourself.
He stared, dumbstruck.
Was that what she thought?
You say this, Akamian breathed, because you know me so well.
He reached out, traced the pale edge of her breast with a finger.
And Kellas, so little.
No man is that remarkable. I'm a whore, remember?
We'll see, he said, tugging her down.
They kissed, long and deep.
We?
She repeated, laughing as though both hurt and astounded.
It really is we now, isn't it?
With a shy, even scared smile, she helped him pull free his weathered robes.
When I can't find you, he said,
or even when you turn away, I feel hollow, as though my heart's a thing of smoke. Isn't that we?
She pressed him against the mat, straddled him.
I recognize it,
she replied, tears now streaming down her cheeks.
So it must be.
One lamb, Akamian thought, for 10 bulls. Recognition. He hardened against her, ached to know her again. As always, the images flickered, each as sharp as glass. Bloodied faces, the clash of bronze arms, men consumed in billowing sorceries, dragons with teeth of iron. But she raised her hips, and with a single encompassing thrust, sheared away both past and future, sparing only the glorious pang of the present. He cried out. She began grinding against him, not with the expertise of a harlot hoping to abbreviate her labor, but with the clumsy selfishness of a lover seeking surcease, a lover or a wife. Tonight she would take, and that, Akamia knew, was as much as any whore could give. Wearing a harlot's face, it sat in the blackness, its ears pricked to the sounds of their lovemaking, glistening sounds, a mere arm's length away, and it thought of the weaknesses of the flesh, of all the needs that it was immune to that made it powerful, deadly. The air was suffused with their groaning scent, the heady perfume of unwashed bodies slapping in the night. It was not an unpleasant smell, too devoid of fear, perhaps. The sound and smell of animals, aching animals. But it knew something of their ache. Perhaps it knew far more. Appetite was direction, and its architects had given it direction. Such exquisite hungers. Ah, yes, the architects weren't fools.
There was ecstasy in her face, rapture in deceit, climax in the kill, and certainty in the dark.